If the promise of the coming Messiah was clearly announced in the Old Testament, why did no one want to believe it from the lips of Jesus until after the resurrection? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson from the Walla Walla University School of Theology. I'm your host, and joining me as conversation partners are two of my colleagues, Larry Baverka and Dave Thomas. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's go to a key Old Testament passage that announces the Messiah, Genesis 3:15. How much does that actually tell us? It's typically been taken as the proto-evangelium, the first gospel. But if you actually look at it in the context of Genesis 3 from an Old Testament perspective, what does it say and what does it not say? Can we have any thoughtful reflections from our panel members?
Well, the first thing it says is that the serpent and the woman are going to hate each other. They're going to be bitter enemies. And that's going to continue through generations. And at some point, one of her descendants is going to give him a blow to the head, and he's going to retaliate by striking the other on the heel.
Mm-hmm. That's much easier to see once the serpent is identified as a satanic figure in the New Testament. In fact, one of the puzzles in the Old Testament is the serpent in the wilderness, for example, was raised as a salvific figure.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. So in the Old Testament, it's not at all clear that the serpent is a hostile enemy to God. It's created by God. And then actually, in the Egyptian religion, it could be a good deity or an evil deity. So we don't expect the same clarity. But when you come back to it from the other side of the cross, then you say, aha, that's the clue. In any event, that's the first passage that Christians have taken, aha, the Lord was up to something, and he dropped a little bit of a clue there.
Well, I think that's true if you keep it as a little bit of a clue.
Yeah.
I agree with Larry that it does set up the prospect of a long conflict or controversy mm-hmm. between those two. It establishes two sides in this equation, and then a long conflict at which point one of the descendants of the women will triumph over the others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I agree, I don't think somebody in the Old Testament reading that would have put Jesus in there. That's something that we do after knowing about the New Testament.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Now, the next announcement is one which is really haunted Christians. My explanation of that is a much more natural one, is what I like to do in my classes is trace the progressive effect of sin just by highlighting the key events that happened after Genesis 3. You have Cain and Abel, you have the flood, you have the Tower of Babel. It's a long downhill slide until you get to Abraham, and that's where Joshua 24:2 says Abraham's own family worshipped other gods. Now, why didn't Abraham react against the suggestion that he should offer Isaac as a sacrifice? You would expect him to complain about that.
Well, particularly in light of this is the promised one through whom his descendants are going to multiply, and he was pretty difficult in coming as a child of their old age. Mm-hmm. So you would expect, yeah, you're right, you would expect some, wait a minute, you've promised this, but now you're asking to bring all of that to some sort of end.
And Dave, you have two boys. What would have happened had you gotten a vision at an earlier stage in your life? Your boys are probably can run faster than you now. But at an earlier point in your life, if you had gotten a vision for you to sacrifice them, what would you have thought of such a vision?
Boy, that's, you know, I think it would have been very difficult for me to think that that had come from God.
It'd be more like a nightmare.
Yeah.
In fact, you'd be inclined to think it probably came from the devil.
Yeah, or from...
Or too much pizza late at night.
Yeah, too much something late at night. I don't... You know, I can't help but think that Abraham was driven by the societal understanding of offering children in times of dire mm-hmm. emergency. And I've always thought that that kind of conditioned him to be accepting of this. He figured that if God was asking this, given the fact that this was a known practice in, amongst other gods, that this was not an outlandish or unfair request for God to make, and so he went ahead with it.
Yeah.
Another option is that Abraham had such incredible faith in God's ability to keep his promises that he anticipated that God would somehow work it out so mm-hmm. that he would keep his word.
Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, I used to worry about two things. I didn't worry a lot about my dad getting a vision and taking me to the mountaintop, but I did worry more about how a God who said you shall not kill would come at this point. And I think, Dave, your suggestion there is the lines where I would go. In fact, Micah 6:6-8 is really quite astonishing, and someone just recently pointed out one of the modern translations that really helps here. Let me just read it for you. Micah 6, we're familiar with verse 8. He has told you, O mortal, what is good. But let's pick it up with verse 6. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Now, if you put that in modern terms, you go from bicycle to Volkswagen to Cadillac to Rolls Royce. See? And the last one up there is, shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? And then, without any further explanation, it says, he has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. Now, the wrinkle that I just heard recently, the Good News Bible actually puts a no in there. Mm. No. He has told you, O mortal, what is good. But I don't think you put that psychology to rest until Jesus comes and pays the price. And that's what you find back with Abraham. Abraham followed because it was the societal thing to do. But God intervenes and says, I will provide the sacrifice for you. And the ultimate fulfillment of that then is in the person of Jesus Christ. But that was a long time in coming before people actually were able to understand that. Now, where else would you go in the Bible to get an announcement of someone who is to come, the Messiah? What comes to mind? Any passages? I think of, for example, when Jesus was on the road to Emmaus, remember, where mm-hmm. he began and gave all these messianic prophecies?
Well, I would include Isaiah 53.
You'd include Isaiah 53?
Yeah, although from an Old Testament perspective, they might not have, they don't read that the way we would read it.
In fact, that seems to be the one aspect that Jesus picked up from the Old Testament that nobody wanted to hear.
Yeah, and that is an interesting twist. That if this, how do you explain that all? And you're an Old Testament prof. How is it that this theme, which we see in the, you know, as New Testament people, we see this or claim it to be so prominent in the Old Testament? How is it that it was lost by the time Jesus comes, so that people are shocked about the very thought of it?
Well, that I think is really one of the fascinating things, and I think one of the reasons why Jesus, the incarnation of God, is so crucial, because when God comes, he completely eliminates any kind of violent response to human beings. Now, he still has some pretty nasty bites in some of the stories, but, you know, as I ask my students, how many people did Jesus kill? Zero. Here is God in human flesh, loving the enemies, turning the other cheek, people listening to it. They can't really understand that, and they don't really understand until after the resurrection. See? God is right to promise deliverance, but what is the spiritual danger of being delivered too readily and too quickly from your enemies?
Mm.
It's interesting, as Jesus preached or expounded on the passage that he read in Nazareth, which he, I think, laid claim to as one of the clearest statements outlining his mission. He read the passage and then stopped mid-verse and did not proceed on with the references to the restoration and the great day of the Lord. Most of the people who were anticipating a Messiah were doing so by combining those prophecies of the first and second coming and seeing no time frame of difference in between. And that's easy to do, it seems to me, as you read the Old Testament. The great day of the Lord, the restoration, all this sort of thing, all happens at once. And God intervenes and he puts the offending and oppressive nations, deals with them unjustly and brings evil to an end. Mm-hmm. And so the anticipation that that's what the Messiah was going to do was, I think, very deeply embedded in their thinking and anticipation. And obviously being an occupied country drove that even further.
Mm-hmm. Does a pastor, does a parent have a right to be selective in their reading of Scripture? Now, the reason I'm asking that question, you know, Jesus, in quoting Isaiah 61, stopped short, as you mentioned.
Right.
The day of vengeance of our God. The people were just waiting for that, and yep. Boom, he quit. See,
mm-hmm.
Now, Ellen White does something very similar. When she is quoting Exodus 34, 6 and 7, she stops short after forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, stops there instead of, and who will by no means clear the guilty.
Mm-hmm.
She's trying to emphasize the positive side of God, and so she stops there. Isn't that part of our responsibility as pastors, as teachers, to give the message that's needed? You don't have to read all Scripture all the time, do you?
Well, preachers certainly use the portion of Scripture that make the point that they feel constrained to make.
Uh-huh.
So if that's what you're asking, I would say...
So if you're dealing with a gentle child, you don't clobber them.
No.
You give them the gentle message.
Yeah.
See? And if you're dealing with a child with a thick skull, then you bring out the heavier stuff. And I think there's this powerful tendency for groups to want to beat up on their enemies. See? And so when...
Some have no mission unless they can define an enemy.
That's right. See? So I think that particular tendency is there much in human beings, and perhaps that's one reason why Jesus came to live, to suffer, and die, and it was only after the resurrection that you could then begin to see some of those other aspects again. The true message of this cross was hard for Jesus to bear. It's hard for us to bear. And it's a challenge for us to live that out today. My thank you to Larry and to Dave. Next week, we're going to pick up the atonements and symbols. My thanks also to Josiah Hackerott, our program engineer, and for each of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Walden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.